So I want to talk tonight about bodhisattva practice. And maybe some of you have heard that term, maybe some of you haven't. Bodhisattva is a being who practices for the well-being and benefit of other beings. And the neat thing about that is that, of course, you also benefit yourself when you are benefiting others. However, the focus of the bodhisattva's life is actually on the well-being of others, that others may awaken. And the word literally means enlightening being, bodhi being enlightenment, and sattva being a being. There are classical, you might call them archetypal bodhisattvas in the Buddhist stories. If you read them, you will encounter them. They sound kind of like these great, wonderful, mythical ideals of human behavior. But there's also a tradition of talking about bodhisattvas as us, as ordinary beings who take on this practice of practicing for the benefit of others. So I want to talk about both bodhisattvas, both the kind of archetypal, great, classic figures in Buddhism that we can aspire to be like them, and we can ask them for their support when we find that we may need that. But I also want to talk about the practice of being a bodhisattva, taking the vows of the bodhisattva to practice for the benefit of others. And I'm going to do this in a way that is perhaps untraditional. I don't think that it is, I think it's kind of fundamentally traditional, but I don't know that I've read it or seen it in other Buddhist assemblies. I'm going to talk about it in the context of what I call the mandala of our whole beings, which is to look at these things from the perspective of the mind, and the body, and the spirit, and the heart. I've been studying this kind of way of thinking about our life for quite a while because I find it personally very helpful. I think for one reason, some of us, we have tendencies where we tend to be more mental or we tend to be more physical. We tend to be more of an emotional person or we tend to be more of a spiritual person. And I think that all of these, I'm going to call them the quadrants, each of these quadrants is an important part about being human. I don't think one is superior to the other. I think in our lives, perhaps we might even move through favoring. Maybe for a while we're kind of more mental, we study a lot, and then maybe we get involved in relationship and we start doing heart and emotion practice. Maybe then we start wanting to study about the great bodhisattvas and looking into spirit and spiritual tradition. Maybe we start looking at our own physical actions and our bodies. So I think individually we can learn by dwelling and studying in each of these quadrants. And I think that as a community, we all can kind of be one complete whole by having diversity in terms of how we approach practice and what we study and how we study. So I've thought about these four quadrants, and I've thought about, okay, which is the classical bodhisattva that dwells in each of these quadrants? So I want to start there. And then I want to talk about, and what might be a way that a lowly little, you know, imperfect being such as me or you might practice this way of each of these quadrants. And then I want to see what you think about this and see what kinds of questions and discussion you might have. So I want to start with spirit, the quadrant of spirit. And I put Avalokiteshvara in there. And Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of compassion and is thought of as the bodhisattva that hears the cries of the world and responds to the cries of the world. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. This is the first of the bodhisattva vows. Even though there's no end to humans, and there's no end to the needs that people have, I'm still going to do what I can to help everybody wake up to this precious life that we have been given. That's what we mean by save in Buddhism. We don't mean try to convert people or preach to people about how great Buddhism is, you know, save souls. By save, we really mean actually support their awakening to their own true nature. And I've even heard this vow translated as, sometimes beings are numberless, I vow to awaken with them. But the traditional translation is, I vow to save them. So think of that as, you know, saving a being means being completely present with that other person, not putting your own stuff on them, really giving them space to be who they are and encouraging them in their own unfolding of their own wisdom and their own insight. Avalokiteshvara has compassion for the vast diversity of all the creatures of the world. If you see statues or pictures of Avalokiteshvara, who actually shows up as both male and female, in India, Avalokiteshvara is male, but in China, maybe you've heard of Kuan Yin, that's the same bodhisattva, and she's a female. Tara is also, in the Vajrayana Tibetan tradition, is a form of this same bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara has, you know, like 1,000 arms and 1,000 hands and eyes on all the arms and all the hands. And I was even reading that in each hand is an implement, a different implement, so that no matter what the need is, that all these endless beings are help, help. Mm-hmm. Avalokiteshvara just has the tool and just, you know, skillful means, uses whatever means is necessary. Well, not doing bad things, but, you know, depending on what is arising out there, Avalokiteshvara responds skillfully with the intention of helping the other beings awaken. Compassion, support, encouragement, generosity. And in the Buddhist practices, Avalokiteshvara is often kind of associated with devotional practice. So, for example, the founder of, our teacher's teacher, and one of the founders of this practice place, Suzuki Roshi, his mother was a Japanese woman, and every day she used to pray to the Japanese form of this bodhisattva, Kanzeon. In the Lotus Sutra, there's a prayer, you know, basically, no matter what kind of trouble I get into, I know you're going to be able to help me, is kind of the nature of the prayer. And this prayer, you know, that's devotional. We don't really do that so much here. You know, you came tonight and we sat zazen and everybody looks kind of somber and quiet. You know, we didn't like all of a sudden start going, help, Avalokiteshvara, you know, whatever problem I'm in, I know you're going to save me. But that actually is a practice in Buddhism. And it was the practice of Suzuki Roshi's mother that she did every day. Every day she asked and thanked this being, this kind of magical, mythical being for helping her. So the way that I think of this in terms of my own life, when I think of this having this spirit of compassion and this vow of even though beings are numberless, I vow to save them. I vow to awaken with them. I think about this as really believing in people's potential. That's kind of the practical way that I find this vow shows up for me, is really believing, no matter what it looks like over there, no matter how unskilled or difficult a person or a situation may be, I believe that they do have the potential to awaken. That's the vow. Does that mean I don't get mad at people? Of course not. I get mad at them. And I might for a moment think, well, not that being. They're not going to wake up. Everybody else is, but not that one. That one is too messed up, right? But here's the thing with these vows, you know. On the other hand, it can't be too long. before I have to challenge myself to go, wait a minute. What about this vow that I have as an aspiring bodhisattva? You know, all beings are numberless. I vow to save them. It doesn't say I vow to save some of them. So then, if I'm really going to put this into practice, I have to believe in the potential that everybody has to grow and to learn. And so, you know, what does that look like? So those are some thoughts about this, the what I call the quadrant of the spirit, you know, having this spirit. So then there's the mind. The mind. Oh, I call it the generous spirit. Right, the generous spirit. So then there's the mind. And the bodhisattva that I'm associating with the mind and the mental side of things is Manjushri. Manjushri is wisdom and discerning wisdom. Okay, Avalokiteshvara, I've got 1,000 arms, 1,000 hands, I'll meet your need. Manjushri's like, get to the point. Manjushri has a sword. Very different energy, okay, but equally valuable at different times of our lives. Manjushri is traditionally wisdom and insight, and particularly the discrimination, not like discriminating of this against that, but being able to kind of have this penetrating view about the essential way that we're actually empty of fixed identity. This is something we've been studying and talking about on Sunday nights, this teaching in Buddhism of the emptiness teachings. It's kind of difficult because, of course, we don't feel that to be true. I mean, this teaching is that even though I think I'm here and you're there, and I think that we're these two separate beings, and in truth, we actually are intimately and intricately related with one another. That the things that I think about you, I think it's over there and that it's real, but it's actually happening here. So it's this whole very penetrating and challenging way of looking at kind of deconstructing what we think is true, challenging our own mental sense of what we make up about the world and what we think is true. It's rigorous. Manjushri, it's a rigorous side of the quadrant. And in terms of how it shows up in you know, the vow, I think it's the one, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. So even though my mind, my human mind, will always be creating this belief that I'm here and you're there and I'm right and you're wrong and this is how it is and I know that this is how it is, which we call delusion in Buddhism, even though I'll always be thinking that because I'm human and it's okay, I'm going to vow to end it. That's the bodhisattva vow. The bodhisattva does the impossible with happiness. The bodhisattva doesn't go, oh no, you know, it's hopeless, therefore I'm going to give up. The bodhisattva goes, bring it on. Yeah, delusions are inexhaustible, and I'm going to make every effort that I can to really study my mind and study how I create these constructs about what I think is true that actually end up oppressing others. Because how do I really know what's true for you? How do I know? I don't. You know? I don't. So releasing the grip of the fixed views, you know, is the daily practice, I think, of this kind of Manjushri. I call it the flexible mind. So the generous spirit, the flexible mind. And then we get to the heart, okay? So spirit, mind, and then we get into feeling and emotion. This was a little harder in terms of the bodhisattvas because I wasn't quite sure. I mean, Manjushri, that seemed really clear for the mind, and Avalokiteshvara felt like, yeah, for spirit. But I had to kind of poke around a little bit for this one, and I came up with Maitreya because Maitreya is the loving kindness bodhisattva. Maitri means metta, you know, metta sutta, the practice of metta where you intentionally wish good upon others. Maitreya, that's Maitreya's name. So even though I know we sometimes talk about Maitreya as the future Buddha, and I don't want to get into all the religious discourse and argument about future Buddha here tonight, I'm thinking of it more, Maitreya, as the loving kindness Buddha, and metta practice, the practice of the heart. This, when I studied a little bit about this, I didn't know this surprised me. You know, a lot of people, there's that figure of the fat, happy Buddha. For a lot of people, they think that is Buddha, you know. A lot of people have that association. That's actually the Chinese Hote, who is Maitreya, and I didn't know that, but I learned that. The Chinese version of Maitreya is Hote, and there was this beautiful description of Hote as the one, you know, with the big stomach who can take it, who can take emotion. I mean, when you think about emotion, I think often it does live in the stomach. You know, when we're nervous about something that we have to do, I don't know about you, but you get a stomach ache, or you get an uneasy stomach, or you say, oh, I don't have the stomach for that, right? Well, Hote, this bodhisattva, does. Big stomach, big heart. So this is something that we can all open to as well. And in the vow, for me, this one is Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them, which basically means whatever is happening is my teacher. Everything that's arising, I vow to enter it. It's a gateway, and I vow to go through it. To me, this really takes a very, very strong heart, because we get very defensive with one another often when we encounter the challenge of a Dharma gate. Oh, I'm not going through that one. I'm not going to do this with that person. This is too hard. I can't do this. So the practice of this quadrant of the heart is actually opening the heart, opening to the experience at hand. I think of it as sort of riding the waves of human emotion. You just ride those waves. You ride it. And you have a brave heart. I call this quadrant brave heart. Then there's body, and Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva of activity and action, enlightening action. Trungpa says Samantabhadra is nourished by the world. I love that term, nourished by the world. So body, action, engagement, connection, is the realm of Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, who rides an elephant, by the way, which I just think is such a great vision, nourished by the world. And this one is Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. What is Buddha's way? What is Buddha's way? What is it that we vow to become? We're in Buddha's way, we're actualized by the world. We're actualized by the myriad things. It's not a solo activity. It's interactive. It's relational. We receive our nourishment from being in the world, and we grow and develop as humans through interaction. So this is the quadrant of the body. So I wanted to stop. We still have a nice lot of time, because I didn't want to just spout off these thoughts. I actually wanted to put some of my thinking out there and then see what you might be interested in talking about. With relationship to this bodhisattva practice with relationship to this idea of having this mandala of mind, body, heart, and spirit that we can use with each other and in ourselves to bring forth different aspects of our lives and practice. So I'm just curious if anything is going on in anybody's head or heart that they'd like to say or ask, that we could go there.
Can you give an example of a practice that we might find familiar and locate them in each quadrant?
Sure. Well, which one do you want to start with? Which one do you want to start with?
Body.
Body. Okay.
Relational body.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the practice of being aware of others and sensing, not just putting ourselves upon the world and having the focus be upon our own needs and our own thoughts, but actually including in our perceptual field, being aware of the reactions of others and sensing what's coming up for others, watching people's body language, their nonverbal communication, and then actually being in relation and responding to that, rather than just sort of, as Dogen says, you know, putting ourselves upon the world, actually making space for listening, sensing, responding to others. That would be one example. And for heart, well, I think metta, the classic metta practice, is wonderful there. I know for myself, when I feel my heart closing down and feeling mad at somebody or irritated with somebody, that when I can remember to, if I can start wishing them well, that that energy can be transformed. And my own tightness, even though I think I'm right, it doesn't feel so good, that tight heart. And so it actually starts feeling better if the heart can relax and open by remembering that I love that person. Or if I don't know that I love that person, at least thinking, well, they are a person that somebody loves, you know, not making them so much of an object. Mind, well, I think with the mind, it's really examining our thinking, sitting down and challenging ourselves. Why do I think that? Do I really know if that's true or not? Why do I think this is happening? What might be going on for the other person? Why might this be coming up for me? Has this ever happened to me before? You know, rather than just taking it at face value and being reactive. And for spirit, a practice, well, it's interesting because we were talking about it last Wednesday night. You were talking about aspiration. Kokia, was that Wednesday night? I think with spirit that, and I used the example, we were talking about aspiration. I said it was like breathing, you know, respiration, aspiration. I think there's a certain kind of like spirit that you have to bring forth. I don't think it just falls out of the sky. So if I actually want to live as a person for whom it is true that I have the vow that I wish to awaken with everybody, and I'm not in contact with that, I may need to rouse that aspiration. I may need to call it forth. I think that ritual is one way that we do that collectively here, maybe through some of our chanting. That might be a way, yeah, that I actually do that on my own sometimes, you know, like chant to Avalokiteshvara. I think that's part of the idea with the devotional practices that people do. You know, I have a poster of Avalokiteshvara up above my desk And sometimes I just sit and look at it, you know, some support to remember and connect with that which is bigger than me, than this one. So those would be some thoughts. Patrick.
You're referencing vow associated with bodhisattvas, the vow to all beings. When do you do that? When do you take on a vow? How do you what is the practice of vow?
I find for me that it's helpful to repeat them a lot so that they kind of sink into my kind of deep structure of my body-mind as something that I can access and call forth and call up, so that I tend to most learn when I'm having something that I'm struggling with. And so if I have these vows inside me, then say if I'm struggling in the heart dimension and I don't want to go through that Dharma gate, I just remind myself that actually I do. Or just even the fact of recognizing, oh, it's a Dharma gate rather than it's an obstruction, you know, that concept. Oh, it's not an obstruction, it's a Dharma gate. And what's my vow? Oh, my vow is to enter it. Oh, okay. What would that look like right now? Entering that Dharma gate. Or delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Struggling with some ideas, struggling with some thinking, you know, recognizing that I'm suffering and going, well, is there some other way that I could be doing this right now rather than suffering with this? Oh, maybe I'm holding to a fixed view. Maybe I'm actually engaging in delusion. What's my vow? Oh, I vow to end delusion. What might that look like right now? Ending delusion. Well, how about if I change my mind about what I'm thinking about this person? Oh, he's lazy. Oh, he's whatever. You know, what if I just tell myself no? That's not true. You don't know. You don't know what's really going on. Let it go. You know, end that delusion. So I'm kind of a practical type, but I also really believe in repetition and loading up these words and these intentions and these thoughts inside us so that we have it as a resource to draw from. I sit and cry. I sit and cry. I whine to Jean. Wah, wah, wah. I hate life. I'm such a failure. I'm such a rotten priest. I'm a no good Buddhist. You'd think after all these years of chanting these vows and really believing this stuff that it would make me better. Shucks. But then I have the opportunity to save this one, to have compassion for this one, to go, oh, can I be kind with my own failure? Can I be kind with my own sense of being inadequate? I think that's part of this. There's like an inherent impossibility that's wired into the bodhisattva vow, you know, and just the expectation that there would be this ideal state where of perfection in a way, the Bodhisattva vow is recognizing that, you know, it's not about getting somewhere. It's not about that all beings will ever actually really be saved, because they're numberless. You know, so if I'm looking for evidence, it's not about that. So I don't know. I think that can help. Did I see your hand? No. Okay.
My question is really similar to where we've been with this, and I don't know if we can kind of open it up some more, but it's about the helpfulness aspect of, you know, looking at this mandala of vows and support. And I'm still, my question is still, well, when I'm stuck, I'm just so blind. You know, when I'm suffering, I don't know how to open up that helpfulness. And actually what you just said to Dana was very helpful, and was something that resonated, that step of, can I be kind to this state? Can I trust this very messy, painful, what's right here? Can mm-hmm. I actually love that? Mm-hmm. Trust that, and be that. But you know, it's that place where all the cool other stuff that sometimes is very helpful when I can access it is just not available.
It's not easy. And there, I don't think there's a perfect state. I think it's an ongoing, lifelong practice. But I think we can also encourage each other. I mean, I think that's why we practice in community. And why we have, you know, teachers, be they formal teachers or serving as each other's teachers, you know, when we need help, asking.
Makes me think of what I asked for when I first started coming to the Zen Center. I still want this, by the way. I just wanted a syllabus that when I got done, boy, there was no problem. And I wanted to start here, and I wanted to move right through it. I still want that, so if anybody's got it, you can hand it over. Thank you.
The kind of mandala thing, I think there's a way that... we can use it diagnostically, you know, with ourselves and others, where sometimes, like, we can be excessive in one of the quadrants, and then it can be really helpful to just try another one. Like, for example, I was having a really good conversation with a friend about this, where she was saying how she's just feeling really stuck, and she's been kind of chronically stuck, and I asked her, you know, have you... And I know she's somebody who in the past has done therapy. And I said, well, are you in therapy right now? And she goes, no, you know what? It's not psychological. She said, I totally understand this from a psychological dimension. She says it's spiritual. And that was really powerful. Oh, you know, problem. You know, some of us tend towards maybe, you know, a psychological angle or a mental angle. And when she said it was spiritual, then I thought, oh, now that would open up actually a whole other set of behaviors or taking it into the body. I know, like for me, I tend to get stuck in the mind, and sometimes my body, you know, friend just says, you know, kind of grabs me and pulls me outside and makes me take a walk. And I'm like kicking and screaming the whole way. No, I don't want to walk. I want to stay here and fester in my, you know, my stuff. And he's like, just get out there and walk. And lo and behold, isn't it so that as I walk, you know, things start to open up, things start to, you know, shift. But it, and it wouldn't have happened had I stayed in the mind. But I think also for some people, they need to go into the mind. You know, for some people, it's like, would you please take a look at that? Would you please get some discriminating wisdom about your fuzziness? You know, you know, if you're just always, or if you're just always kind of, oh, in the spirit, oh, I'm so spiritual, la, 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 la. You know, some people, you know, pull them down to the ground, you know, trip them, see what they do. You know, think on your feet, you know. So I think that there's this way that if we think of the whole as we can't be all of it all the time, but we can, you know, kind of shift and dance and be pulled and fall in ways that you know, we can find our way maybe by having some diversity of what we do or how we approach it or even what we study. You know, another piece that I didn't really talk about was that Tigan, Dan Layton, he has a book about bodhisattva archetypes where he associates each of the different bodhisattvas with kind of a school of Zen and a type of teaching. And so he said that, you know, Samantabhadra is like the big, and this won't make a lot of sense to you if you haven't studied them, so don't worry if it doesn't make sense, but for the a few who have, I just want to say this. You know, Samantabhadra is really active in the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is this kind of cosmic visionary description of the interconnectedness of the universe. And a lot of Samantabhadra in there, right? Whereas Manjushri is more the emptiness teachings, you know, like what we're studying on Sunday night. That would be kind of Manjushri land. And then he said that Maitreya is really associated with the Yogacara, which is the looking at consciousness and kind of at psychology. And then Avalokiteshvara is more associated with some of the devotional practices. So even there, you know, there's different tastes of the Dharma at different times. And there, it's not like because one is helpful, the other is not. They all have their function. It's a matter of use in the appropriate situation, to quote our friend. Yeah.
Following that, would you say that if I'm, you know, we have the saying, we can only get up from where we have fallen. Are you saying that if I'm falling down in the quadrant of mind, I'm looking to get up there? Or am I looking to one of the other quadrants for the support?
I would say either. I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's a, I would say from my experience, there's a definitive. I think both could be true. I mean, because sometimes it's like you're in it and that's where you need to be and you just need to not turn away and you need to stick with it and that's where the opening is. But I think other times it's about shifting and letting go of something. I don't know. Play around with it. Tell me what you discover. There's a couple of things that others have written that I have found to be helpful about this bodhisattva practice. This is something that I found Musong, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but I really like his writing. He's a contemporary Buddhist scholar, and he's done a lot of translations. So this is, I think it's from his introduction to the Diamond Sutra or something. They say that bodhisattvas are willing to put off their own enlightenment until all beings are enlightened. This activity rests on a seeming paradox. Bodhisattvas understand that in the absolute sense, there are no separate beings that need to be enlightened. A scientist looks deeply into matter with an electron microscope and sees that at its core, matter is energy. At the unimaginable heart of the atom, we have found no solid object, but rather a dynamic pattern of energy, relationship, and pattern of vibration. A bodhisattva looks deeply into human existence and sees that each of our forms are compounded entities created and held in place momentarily by conditioning factors. Each of us is empty of own being. This perception of the essential interrelated nature of all phenomena is what is called wisdom in Mahayana Buddhism. And yet, as Musang says, the rarefied air of this wisdom is hard to breathe because we live in the relative, not in the absolute realm. And this is where the bodhisattva comes in. The bodhisattva actually bridges this wisdom, which can seem like, how can I grasp this when I'm here? The bodhisattva is actually the bridging function. Because the bodhisattva is not bothered by this seeming paradox or contradiction. That's where the bodhisattva lives. The acceptance of paradox is at the core of the bodhisattva vow. And there's another quote along those lines by priests. I forget his first name. He has a book called The Wisdom of Imperfection. It's a wonderful book. And he says, a bodhisattva chooses to live within this paradox of knowing deeply the illusory nature of the world he or she inhabits while still being willing to remain within it. A bodhisattva's vision of awakening remains embodied and therefore has consequences that reach far beyond the limitations of our normal human experience. Opening fully to one's innate luminosity and clarity has an extraordinary effect on the mind. It can generate a quality of intention that has immense power and inspiration behind it, radically changing the nature of intention. The bodhisattva, by remaining at this paradoxical threshold between form and emptiness, opens to a source of creative vitality that is channeled through intention. So, I don't know, that might be enough, unless there's something else. I think that's enough. So now we'll chant the Bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.